And I really think we're at the point now where if we can coalesce all the disciplines needed to accelerate plant breeding, we can make a major step change and accelerate variety development and create varieties with a lot more traits or phenotypes than what we're capable of creating now.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor in Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Stephen Lommel. He is the William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor of Plant Pathology, the Director of the North Carolina Agricultural Research Service, and Associate Dean for Research in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at North Carolina State University. Stephen, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's really great to have you here with us today. And as always, to start things off, just want to ask you if you can share with us a little bit about your path and where you've been and where we are today.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you. I'm excited to be on the podcast. I'll go way back. I grew up in an agricultural region of the Central Valley of California. Well, my family were not farmers per se. I grew up and worked as a child and as a young adult in the ag industry. It was big ag. It was big centralized agriculture, big factories, big canneries, things like that. So I was interested in agriculture from a very, very young age. And then I went to the University of California, Berkeley, which at the time had a very strong agricultural program and a lot in a plant pathology department. I was interested in plant pathogens. So matriculated through there, received a master's and PhD degree in virology. I worked on virus diseases of plants. And then I got an assistant professor position at Kansas State University from 1983 to 1988, where I know you've had some experience with. And I had a great time there, did a lot more applied virology, implied plant pathology, mostly with the major crops in Kansas, wheat and corn. And then in 1988, I moved here to North Carolina State University, where I've been for the last 36 years. And I had a pretty broad research program. I was doing basic virology, looking at the mechanisms of pathogenesis and movement, while at the same time doing applied research and disease issues, looking at the indexing of viruses, determining the causal agents of a number of diseases out here in North Carolina. And I had a very productive research program for about 25 years. And then I was invited into administration to put a biotechnology program together, which I did. And then one thing led to the other, and I moved into administration full time about probably 11 or 12 years ago. And I really like research. I'm excited about building things. I'm a builder. And I've built a number of research ag programs in the college, as well as several buildings. So I'm at the twilight of my career now, and I'm just finishing off on a couple of recent large projects. And frankly, I'm thinking about another large project having to do with the federal government and agricultural research funding.
Perfect. This is super. I'm super excited. I guess I told you this earlier because at least of the guests that I've interviewed, you perhaps is the first one that has had a huge and still has a huge impact on the research side and is also in the shoes of administrators and doing those tasks. And so I think it's a really nice mix of experiences and also topics that we're going to cover today. Really excited for that. All right. So, you know, given, you know, the breadth of the work that you've done and also the work that you've helped to get going and establishing, you know, and having this very high level view of the system overall, you know, we have some big issues or some big challenges that agriculture is helping to address. So we know population is increasing. We have higher demand for plant products of all sorts, food, feed, fuel, others. And at the same time, we have climate change going on. So we need more, and we're being more challenged to produce that greater supply of goods. And so my question to you is, what do you think is the role of plant breeding to help us to tackle these challenges, right? So produce more with ever more challenging conditions.
Well, let me just first preface what I'm about to say is that I'm not a plant breeder, but we have about 44 plant breeding programs in our college, and I've become a real believer in plant breeding solving a lot of the problems you just brought up. And I really think we're at the point now where if we can coalesce all the disciplines needed to accelerate plant breeding, we can make a major step change and accelerate variety development and create varieties with a lot more traits or phenotypes than what we're capable of creating now. Our best plant breeders are doing a great job producing crops with more yield and disease resistance every 5 to 8 years. But I think we're at a point where if we created an interdisciplinary framework, we can generate crops in 3 or 4 years. And instead of juggling 2 or 3 traits, maybe 10, 15, 40 traits. And these traits can extend beyond yield and beyond disease resistance to drought tolerance, to carbon sequestration, to sustainability in different soil types, to nutrition. And so each of these categories require multiple traits, but I think the technologies available with both big data analytics, artificial intelligence, massive genomics, and just integrating these at a large scale. Plant breeders are doing a great job doing it, but I would say, and this is no disrespect to plant breeders, but more at the cottage industry level, I think we need to really industrialize plant breeding. So again, we can start juggling a lot more traits at one time and create a lot more problems. The other thing I think that we can do is we can move away a little bit from having one genotype covering thousands and thousands of acres. And with this multiplexing of all these technologies and multiplexing the number of traits we can juggle, we can create more niche genotypes that will be perfect for this soil condition and this ecological niche and customize things a lot more. Maybe harvest at a broader level, but still create genetics that are much more granular and optimized for small microclimates.
That's fantastic. So I guess, a quick follow-up on that is, where do you think we are in that, in getting there? Like, is that something that we have all these fields, it's just a matter of finding a good way to combining and bringing these people together? Or is it like, what is keeping us from getting there?
I think the desire is there. I think that the interest is there. The science is generally there. Maybe there's some missing pieces. I think it's really systems integration approach, people who do systems integration, and two, money. What I'm talking about is we have the phenome to genome grants and things like this. They're funding at $3 to $5 million. We have grant programs, particularly in USDA. They're kind of small. I'm really thinking a $10, $15, $30 billion approach over a 5 to 10 year period to really rally up all the disciplines together and then have the systems integration over the top to really move the needle. It's a kind of a tired and worn sort of descriptor, but it's kind of like a moonshot. When we went to the moon, it was billions of dollars in the 60s. It was the integration of multiple technologies and multiple disciplines, all the way from physics to avionics, to chemistry, biology. All of these were integrated at multi-billion dollars. I think that's what we need now to really accelerate plant breeding. And we can solve a lot of problems with plant breeding. We can go a long way on human nutrition and human health. we cannot capture all the carbon that's being generated, but there's a significant swath of carbon that can be captured through agriculture that we can do improve through plant breeding and all the other things I brought up.
Well, that's great. So now getting to a different scale here in our conversation. So microbiome, being it from humans, animals, plants, soil, or even other types of media, has received a lot of attention and perhaps is our next knowledge frontier to really change things as we know. And so what I'm trying to get to is, with what we have learned about microbiome, how do you think that it can affect plant and animal agriculture?
I think the microbiome is still is topical and is exceedingly important. And I was remiss in not bringing that up as some of the traits that can be improved in plant breeding. Certainly understanding the microbiome and understanding the interaction between the microbiome and the host plant, both below ground and above ground, that's going to take a lot of basic science. Those are very complex interactions. But again, I think with artificial intelligence and big data analytics, I think we can start addressing these things. But anything we do to increase all these traits and all these traits I was talking about is microbiome understanding and partnering the right microbiome with plants under the right conditions and right soil types is really a part of the driver towards these larger goals. You know, as we all know, this is an old saying, but, you know, a plant and a human, maybe they carry 35,000 genes in their genome, but they probably need 200,000 genes to survive on the planet. It's microbiome that's contributing that delta. And so we are really at a point where we understand that role. We don't know all the details yet, but we understand the significance of it. And that's really part and parcel to this, solving some of these big problems.
All right. So my next question to you here is, what is the role of universities and the government? And I think perhaps you already mentioned a little bit about your thoughts on this, in advancing sustainable agriculture.
I think universities and the government are essential and will be the main drivers of that success. But I don't want to exclude NGOs, don't want to exclude startups and the major companies as well. I think it's a global effort. And I think it takes all of the technology and the skills and talent across all these sectors to address this. But certainly the federal government will be a contributor with various well-conceived grant programs. The universities is where all the talent is, the land grants and the non-land grant universities. And not only it's where the talent is, but it's where we're training the next generation of folks. We're the engine of talent for the future. So universities and the government partnering is certainly critical, but I still don't think it would be successful on its own without creating an entrepreneurial environment and also partnering with the majors and mid-level and small companies as well. And funding. I'm seeing here at my own university, which I'm sure is occurring everywhere else, that the federal government still is the major driver for innovative research, but large philanthropic entities, as well as companies and other kinds of NGOs, are becoming more and more important. They're granting and funding at a very large scale, and they understand that kind of funding is enabling for integrating technologies and really pushing moving the needle on some of these big effects. I seem to be a huge proponent for big grants, and that's what we need to do for this ag moonshot. But we also, all of these people we need to collect for these big projects, they need to have a deep understanding of their disciplines. And so we still need to have individual funded research to create that individual deep knowledge base and then collect these people to go after bigger things. So we need this sort of spectrum of funding, from individual investigator funding to very large, and I mean really large, larger than what we're doing now, big national grants.
Perfect. And, you know, I do want to make a quick connection here between what you just mentioned now with your previous answer. So, you know, so universities are where the current talent is where we're training our new talent. And we're perhaps we need more of that investment, that big investment you were talking about. You know, and you just mentioned a few of these different potential sources of funding to run the Ag Moonshot. So is that something that you still see the government as being the main driver for us to get at those funding levels? Or is it going to be perhaps more evenly distributed across these different areas of funding?
Some listeners might think I'm off the deep end, but I'm looking at a $25 billion kind of level investment. I don't think we can do what my vision says unless we have that kind of level of funding. So I don't think anybody can come to the table with that unless the government is a major player involved. Now, there are a lot of big opportunities for major funding. There's the Novo Nordisk Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Bezos Earth Fund. I can go on and on. There's more of these large philanthropic funding agencies that are interested in the kind of work we do and the kind of solutions we can have. And they're funding. They're funding in the $50-100 million range. And they could be major partners, but to, I think, get to the multi-billion dollar range, we need the government.
All right. So my next question for you here, it perhaps a little bit of a change, shift of gears here, but in your opinion, what is the horizon with food as medicine?
So I'm going to have to give a disclaimer as a scientist and as an administrator. That's not my field, but we do have a lot of people working on that at my university, and as well as I keep tabs of others. I think we're already seeing the beginnings of food as medicine, performance drinks, looking at active compounds and blueberries and carrots and these kind of things. And so I think it's occurring now. And I think the products that are coming out are validated and have been through human clinical studies. So they're just not claims people are making. But I think really to move the needle to if somebody were on a diet from birth, they may never get diabetes, even though that they may be genetically prone to it. I think that's probably 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And I would love to be proven wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to dig a little bit deeper here if you feel comfortable. You know, so you gave some examples here of blueberries and nuts. Is it something specific, perhaps coming out of North Carolina, perhaps from other universities that you've seen that is having, you know, this type of impact? Because I think a lot of times, you know, in the society that we live in, perhaps in the past we thought more as human beings, we thought more of food as medicine in a deeper way. And then at least I feel like overall we lost some of that to believe only on medicine that's being produced by a laboratory. And now coming back to that and bringing those roots back, now do you have some examples that you could give us when it comes to the point of food as medicine?
Again, I'm not in my area of expertise here, but I have seen outputs here at NC State at our Plants for Human Health Institute down in Kannapolis, where people are making products and there's outputs that's validated with the various compounds in blueberries. I would consider that a reductionist approach. People are identifying a single compound and validating that it has some human effect, positive human effect, and then are sort of targeting that compound through plant breeding to increase its availability or increase its production, bioavailability and ability to survive food processing and be bioavailable. But I know there's a lot of studies going on, and I don't have any knowledge of them, but that's more of a holistic approach, not a reductionist approach, looking at whole diets as health factors, you know, reducing animal protein or carbohydrates or all these kind of things. And I think collectively they're all having a positive effect. And I think there's probably going to be a convergence soon on understanding, on data, on human clinical trials and all these things, so that they'll be able to be much more better solutions and recommendations for diets throughout life, and much more customized based on the genotype of the individual as well. But I can't really give you any specific examples. It's just really not my area. You have to get somebody else on the show for that.
That's right. No, that's fantastic, because, you know, I think that, I mean, of course, depends on what crops we're talking and thinking about, but oftentimes, you know, people that are not in ag or not familiar with ag would not really see how agricultural research and our growers, our farmers, can really play a big role when it comes to food as medicine. You know, perhaps just thinking of like corn and soybeans and things that perhaps humans don't even consume as much of what's being produced, at least not directly, and not really thinking about all the diversity of plant products we have and how different ones can play very important roles for us.
Yeah. So again, we're talking really big science here. We need human scientists, human geneticists, nutritionists, human physiologists, all working together with people looking at plants as food. And there needs to be a two-way or a multi-way interaction there. So at the end of the day, getting back to the plant breeder story, you know, plant breeders might get the recommendations or the understanding that if they may need to change three or four genes in a biosynthetic pathway through either conventional means or through gene editing or something like that, to be able to upregulate a suite of compounds or one compound, it may take 5 or 6 traits to do that, or genotypes to do that. But that's the goal, and I think that should be what I feel is the goal of this sort of rapidly accelerating plant breeding and juggling multiple traits at one time.
Perfect. So my next, I guess, big question to you is: so we're in this age where there's, you know, we have so much data, we have the computer power to make sense of it, we have new algorithms, machine learning, AI, that we can deploy in these types of data sets. And so what, you know, I guess my question to you is, you know, being in this administrative role, being able to see the suite of things happening at your university, but also at others, what do you think, what do you see as what is happening on that intersection of all these areas of expertise, and how is connecting all those things as far as, you know, the electronics, the data, the mechanization, genetics, agronomy, weather, environments, all this connecting of all these fields, what's the impact of all these things coming together, and what do you see as the future of that playing a role in it?
I'm using my university as an example, but there's probably better examples of everything I'm about to say at other universities as well. But that has been sort of the big goal of our plant sciences initiative, is we created a culture and a structure to assemble disparate groups of scientists together and assemble them into a newly designed building that's purpose-built to create collisions and bring in teams of very broad disciplines to attack a problem and solve a problem with big funding. The building and the culture and the structure is also designed for these groups to disassemble, repatriate themselves back to their departments, and allow new groups to assemble. And so some of the projects that have been funded are a lot of them are on sensors. We're bringing in multispectral engineers, data scientists. They're working in the same labs with plant physiologists and big data folks, physiologists, soil people, and going after traits, really, to help plant breeders improve crops. So a lot of the work they're doing is on scanning sweet potatoes for shape, their penetration radiation to look at subsurface physiology, scarring, diseases, and things like that. And then these multispectral sensors collect all that data. It's crunched, gives the plant breeders some decisions on what varieties or what genotypes to cross with each other, again, to create better nutrition, better post-harvest physiology, better diseases, more desirable shapes, all these things all at one time. So I actually see it happening. And I know many other schools are doing the same thing. There's a lot of startup companies in this space looking at robotics through fields. Not only robotics to reduce labor, which is the biggest problem in agriculture, but robotics through breeding fields and other kind of fields to create data, generate data to make breeding decisions and crossing decisions for plant improvement. So we're seeing the results of some of that now in some of our own breeding programs. We're developing varieties that are taking one or 2 years less than typically would occur because we're making more better informed and specific crosses instead of a lot more random crosses and then a lot of field surveys with the human eye, getting the human eye out of a lot of these phenotyping and making much better decisions on crossing. So we're already seeing an a collapsing of the number of breeding cycles it takes to develop a variety. And so we're seeing that now, and I think it's going to accelerate because there's a lot of effort going into censoring and these kind of things.
Well, if you're listening to this episode and you're enjoying the conversation, make sure to drop us a like, to subscribe to our podcast, different platforms, whichever one you're listening, and also to share this episode with anyone you think could benefit from learning and listening to this great conversation with Stephen Lommel.
It's time for our famous three.
All right, Stephen. So we're getting towards the last three questions of our episode here. The first one is going to be, what is your favorite or maybe a very useful resource that you have found on the technical side of things that you would like to share with us?
I wasn't prepared for that question, but I'm pretty old school, as you can tell just by looking at me. But I'm a firm believer of thumbing through Science and Nature, reading the opinion articles as well as the scientific articles. They're a great entry point for me. To see, you know, a big discovery in an area and then dig back through the references in that paper to see what the field is about. So I'm kind of a firm believer in those kinds of journals to tell me where things are going. The things I also like about those journals are, as an administrator, they give me a lot of insights on funding and a lot of insights and things that initially I may not consider relevant or part of the fields I'm interested in, but at the end of the day are. One example I'm using now has nothing to do with science, but there's been these big discoveries in gravitational waves. There's all kinds of crazy things going on about teleportation and all that sort of stuff. Well, these gravitational waves were discovered and the Nobel Prize was received because they built a huge interferometer called LIGO. And that's an acronym for a big detector. I think one's in Louisiana and one of them is in Washington. But where am I going with this? People went to Congress and got a multi-billion dollar funding to do this. This is a scale that we need to think about in agriculture. And look at the great discoveries LIGO is doing. But Congress will fund big science. We, as agriculturalists, need to think in big science.
Perfect. All right. So our next question here is going to be similar in the sense of asking for one of your favorite resources, but on the non-technical side. So perhaps more on the professional development side, or really anything that would not be directly plant soils, agronomy, genetics.
Okay. Well, this is going to call me out as a nerd, but as an administrator, I like the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's an administrator journal, but it has a lot of sections on books and professional development. And I read a lot of those. As a matter of fact, I have a professional development book that I've stacked up this computer on, so I'm at eye level. And I got that out of the Chronicle of Higher Education. But it gives you politics of funding. It tells you what's going on at universities, the good, bad, and the ugly. But there's a lot of editorial articles in there, and there's a lot of it's sort of a broad spectrum thing. It gives you book recommendations and things like that in and out of the discipline. So I use that a lot as a reference.
Perfect. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out. It's going to be a new one for me. Yeah. All right. So our next question here is, and I'm super excited. I mean, I've been super excited to hear your different answers to all questions, but I think this one here as well is going to be really interesting because you've, being in an administrative level, you've seen so many more people than somebody at a PI as in a lab does. So in your opinion, what type of skills or skill set sets apart successful professionals?
Okay, so I probably should give you the answer that I've been trained to give you with all my leadership, but throughout my 30 years, I consider the most important trait, and it's greater than all the other ones, is curiosity. I think curious people are the kind of people I want to see and be around. Non-curious people, I just don't see them digging and connecting the dots. So the single trait and the single feature I like to see in people is curiosity. And there's a lot of other traits too, but that to me is the one I always look for.
All right. Well, Stephen, thank you so much. It was great to have you as our guest today. I enjoyed so much our conversation. It's not, we have had exceptional guests. All of our guests are exceptional. And we've had different types of conversation, but at least of the ones that I interviewed, you're the first one that really is in a position that you can give a very overall impactful type of perspective. And I really appreciated exploring that today with you. So thanks so much for being with us today, and thanks for all the insights.
Been a pleasure.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.